now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great nation despite the fact that we are in the midst of great, great polarization and controversy about seemingly everything. Even basic questions of how we teach our children about the world around us. How we teach our children about science. Isn't science supposed to settle arguments? Well, then why are so many arguments engendered by how we teach our kids about science? How we teach them about, say, evolution or Darwin's theory of evolution? Should we be allowed to challenge that in schools? And what about the global warming crisis? Appropriate to exert any skepticism toward that item of the national agenda? To debate these questions, we are blessed with two of the finest advocates for two very different points of view. First of all, Michael Shermer is the editor of Skeptic Magazine. He is also a regular columnist for Scientific American. And he has a new book coming out, which sounds very interesting. I debated him about that new book, even though I haven't seen it, last Thursday in the Freedom Fest. His new book is called The Moral Arc, and it suggests that humanity is moving very much in the right direction. Speaking of moving in the right direction, we are also joined by Dr. Stephen Meyer. Stephen is a graduate, has his doctorate from Cambridge University, and he is the author of the national bestseller, Darwin's Doubt, which is recently out in paperback. He's also the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute here in Seattle. And Stephen mentioned to me that one of the reasons he was very eager and happy for this debate is because Darwin's Doubt, which got some very fine and glowing reviews, also got a very negative review from Michael Shermer's magazine. Michael, you want to start out by explaining the basis for that negativity?
Oh, well, our review of Stephen's book was by Don Prothero, who's one of the world's leading geologists and paleontologists who's done a fair amount of work in this area of the Cambrian explosion, and he sort of just deconstructed Steve's book piece by piece to show that he was wrong.
And wrong in what regard?
Well, I mean, just the term, the Cambrian explosion of life. Most of us think of an explosion as something that happens very rapidly, but in fact, this is a case of many, many millions of years of unfolding. So when a geologist says explosion or it happened rapidly, they don't mean like we mean on a human time scale at all. So what appears to be, you know, a sudden creation of life that implies something like a divine spark, in fact, geologically isn't. I mean, it unfolds over tens of millions of years for the development of these complex life forms. So,
Dr. Meyer?
That particularly mysterious.
Right.
About
well, yeah, Prothero critiqued the book for exaggerating the brevity of the Cambrian explosion. I dated it as a 10 million year event and asserted that between 13 and 16 of the major animal body plans that first arise in the fossil record arose within about a 5 to 6 million year period. Prothero said, well, no, it was not a 10 million year event, it was an 80 million year event. But in order to get that number, he had to include four separate, effectively, explosions. The Ediacaran, an earlier pre-Cambrian event, an event in which the small shelly fossils arise before the first major groups of animals, then the event in which the major animals arise, and then subsequent diversifications of those animals.
Okay,
he then further assumed that all those events were connected and rolled it into one and said that was an 80-million-year event. He also cited two leading Cambrian experts, Valentine and Irwin, and said, you shouldn't read Meyer on this, you should read them. But they also date the event as a 10-million-year event.
Okay. Stephen, if you can explain briefly, why does this matter in regard to our basic understanding of the theory of evolution?
Well, right. The problem of the Cambrian explosion is the problem of the first appearance of the major groups of animals in the fossil record. And they do appear very abruptly without discernible connection to any ancestral precursors in the lower Precambrian rock. So the pattern doesn't match Darwin's expectation of a gradual unfolding of complex forms from simpler forms. And the rapidity of the event, even 10 million years or 5 to 6 million years, is not nearly enough time to generate these new complex forms, given what we know about how fast the Darwinian mechanism of mutation and selection takes place, or rather how slowly it takes place. It must work on small incremental variations and mutations which take great eons of time to accumulate. And even by the kind of mathematical calculations that are made within evolutionary theory in a field called population genetics, if you know something about the mutation rates and the generation times and other factors, you can calculate how much time it would take to generate certain amounts of change. And a 10-million-year window isn't nearly enough time to generate the kind of innovation that we see arising in the history of life with these Cambrian animals.
Okay, Michael Shermer, would you have a problem with someone, say, in a high school biology course trying to at least air the objections or challenges that Stephen Meyer airs in his book?
I guess it would depend on the context and how much time one has to cover the material. If you have several weeks to cover the fossil record, then why not throw in some of the criticisms of it over the last two centuries, say, because there's been a lot of debate. For example, what killed the dinosaurs? You know, was it global warming? Was it an impact, meteor impact? Was it disease? Whatever. So those kinds of debates are fairly normal in science, and there's nothing wrong with that. The question is it really part of the mainstream debate, or is it somebody outside of the debate and who is not a geologist or paleontologist, like Stephen's not, I'm not. So what's the source or context of the criticism? There's nothing wrong with that in principle. I mean, Darwin's had to prove himself that his theory was correct, and that's why he took so long to write his book. And that's how science works. And it's not that science never changes. It changes all the time, but it has to be done along the lines of having good arguments and good evidence to overturn the present theory, and not only overturn the present theory, but replace it with something else that also explains the data and the anomalies that are not explained by the current theory. Any given theory, there's also what's called the residue problem. There's a residue of unexplained mysteries. You know, no theory explains everything. So what do you do with these anomalies, these unexplained mysteries? And, well, that's what graduate students are for. You assign them to those projects to fill. And if they can't, well, perhaps somebody comes along, a young student, that says, hey, no, you're all wrong. Here's the new theory that explains all the old data from the old theory and the anomalies.
Okay, if I can just jump in here, and if we can just focus on something that's maybe a little bit off the beaten path. There's been, since I spoke to you last, Stephen, there have been several discoveries, some of which very provocative, about early ancestors of human beings. And one of the big questions that it seemed to me, do both of you agree that what we call Neanderthal man existed, right? This happened. There was a prior form of hominid that we refer to as Neanderthal.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Why did they go extinct? I mean, these were apparently very intelligent. They were widespread. There is evidence now that they interbred to some extent with what later became Homo sapiens, our own species. Stephen Meyer, why did Neanderthals go extinct while chimpanzees survived?
I really don't have a clearly formulated view on that issue. It is a controversial issue. And in fact, the whole hominid sequence is quite controversial. And I think this is one of the things that gets back to your prior question about education. There are major issues in evolutionary theory, problems with the theory that are not being discussed by the biology textbooks. There was a really important book about 10 years ago that came out with MIT Press called On the Origination of Organismal Form. And the two evolutionary theorists who put out this book said that Neo-Darwinism, the standard theory, is still the standard theory. It's still the orthodox theory, the textbook theory, but it has no real theory of the generative, no explanation for what causes major innovations in form to arise.
Okay, let me, Michael Shermer, very quickly, because we're just about coming out of time.
My point on that is that students aren't hearing about it.
Okay, Michael Shermer, very quickly, your thoughts on why Neanderthals become extinct?
Yep, so there is no agreed upon explanation because we don't have enough data. But it appears that we either outbred them or we outfought them or both. You would only need about a 1% difference in breeding rate for one population to replace another one over the course of a few thousand years, which is about what happened. About 30 to 35,000 years ago is when Neanderthals went extinct and we became the only species there. By the way, about 2% of humans have about 2% Neanderthal DNA. So apparently there were some cold caves on some cold nights that humans and Neanderthals got together.
But okay, we're not in a cold cave. We're in a warm northwest right now. Global warming, questioned. We'll get to that and more with two outstanding advocates.
Michael Medved.
21 minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, and before his most recent bestseller, Darwin's Doubt, Stephen Meyer also did another best-selling book called Signature in the Cell. Stephen Meyer on the Michael Medved Show is the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. Meanwhile, the editor of Skeptic Magazine, Michael Shermer, is the author of a forthcoming book, which sounds fascinating. It's called The Moral Arc. It's about moral progress by humanity over the generations. He is previously the author of best-selling books like The Believing Brain and Why Darwin Matters. We're talking about what we teach our kids regarding science and the extent to which science, it's appropriate to introduce questions about controversial aspects of the scientific record, including evolution and global warming. 1-800-955-1776, our phone number. Michael Shermer, you were saying just before the break, there's something about Neanderthals who disappeared from Earth, at least as far as we know, 30,000 years ago, something that made them very different from a Homo sapiens, the current species of human being.
Yeah, even though their brains were as big as ours, in some cases maybe slightly larger, their culture showed no progress over the course of over 300,000 years in which they were in Europe by themselves before we got there. And like their tools don't change very much at all, whereas our tools, Homo sapien tools, where we lived elsewhere, showed much progress. So it could be that whatever it was about their big brains, they weren't big in quite the same way as ours were, that would lead to cultural progress, cumulative change over time that would allow one generation to teach another generation the progressive change, say, in tools. And they have next to no art at all, and we have art. So there could be just something in the lack of creative spark there.
1-800-955-1776. Gentlemen, would I be correct that what Michael Shermer just described, which is that the lack of development of culture, that that would be true of every non-human species? There haven't been significant changes in elephant's culture or crow culture or dolphin culture over the years, have there, Stephen Meyer?
That's absolutely correct. And there was a really interesting article in Science a few years ago titled Art, Evolution or Revolution? And like agriculture, like complex tool making, like so many things, it was revolution. It comes on the scene very suddenly. The previous forms of life just do not have these higher forms of culture and technology that characterize human beings and which suggests a qualitative difference between humans and other forms of animal life.
And you're including a qualitative difference between human beings and some of our precursors like Neanderthals.
Well, certainly the earlier hominids, one of the controversies about Neanderthal is precisely whether or not it is a distinct species. And I think many paleoanthropologists think it is, but there is some dissenting opinion on that. And just the type of things that might interest students who aren't being exposed to controversies about evolutionary theory in their textbooks.
Let's go to Tim in Pasadena, California. Tim, you're on the Michael Medved Show with another Michael, Michael Shermer and Stephen Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, I have one expertise, and that is art. I'm a fairly well-known artist and done very, very well. But I have to ask you this. Both of you, you both believe in evolution or the Darwin kind of evolution. If evolution means advancement, how do you explain the decline of art? Now, I have to ask, too, do you agree with me that there's been a decline in art?
Wow. Well, first of all, that would not be a Darwinian evolution argument. That would be just cultures either progressing or not. It has nothing to do with Darwinian natural selection. Whether it's progressing or not, I guess the kind of debate that Michael Medved and I just did. And there's a lot of subjectivity there. I mean, where's the Beethovens and the Michelangelos? And people that are artists today might argue, well, I am. Not me. They themselves are. So I'm not sure that's even, you could make that case that art is regressed.
I was just in Florence this summer. I think art has digressed and regressed a bit. I'm also not a proponent of Darwinian evolution, just to clarify things. I'm a skeptic of Darwinian evolution and a proponent of intelligent design.
Well, let me just ask you, if those who don't believe that art has regressed, and I kind of do, the question I would ask is the same kind of question I posed when we were debating last Thursday, Michael Shermer. Who's your favorite contemporary poet, Michael?
Oh, Maya Angelou, probably.
She's no longer with us. And do you think that Maya Angelou, who read the inaugural poem for Bill Clinton's first inauguration, will be remembered, say, in the same context as Robert Frost, who read the the inaugural poem for John Kennedy's inauguration?
Actually, I think she probably will. I can't say I can name a lot of them. It seems like there was a burst of poets in the 19th century. I think you'd have a better case going with that.
Well, a burst of poets in the 20th century, too. I mean, we had American poets from E. Cummings to T.S. Eliot to Ezra Pound.
That's true. Okay.
And the point is, and Carl Sandburg, this is a basic point. It's something I do not understand about our culture, really, which is once upon a time, we had serious novelists who were celebrities and had serious followings. We had poets who mattered. We even had classical composers who reached a huge audience. Today, I think most people would be hard-pressed to think of a, quote, serious novelist, I mean, opposed to somebody who's writing thrillers, not that that can't be serious, or poets or composers, or for that matter, much in the way of contemporary painters, other than, what was a fellow's name who committed suicide, the painter of light, Carlyle, was that, remember him? Yeah, who probably will not be remembered 200 years from now as a great artist. Any comments on this, Stephen Meyer?
Well, I do think there's a general cultural devolution that's taking place as we lose kind of objective standards of morality, objective standards of ethics, and aesthetics. There's a wonderful book by a first-rate aesthete named Steiner, in fact, called Real Presences. And he says that the essence of all great works of art was some sense of the transcendent and some way in which the art pointed us to a realm beyond the merely material. And as we've had an increasing commitment to a materialistic worldview among our top thinkers, I think we've lost any kind of sense of aesthetic beauty and objective standards of same. I'm more of a traditionalist like you, Michael Medved, and think there has been a devolution.
Well, it's one of those things, and I've spoken about this in the realm of music. If you believe that music is a gift from God and that it is something that only human beings can create and respond to, then you may hear music as the voice of angels. And if you believe that human beings are basically just another form of animal, then the music becomes the cry of a wounded animal. And some of contemporary music sounds that way. All right, we will get right back to your calls for Michael Shermer and for Stephen Meyer, talking about what's appropriate to challenge our children with regarding evolution, Darwin, and yes, we'll get to global warming coming up.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. Entertain your brain.
It's awesome.
Every day on The Michael Medved Show.
And yes, we're engaged in a wide-ranging conversation, but that's inevitable and appropriate when you're talking to two such brilliant commentators as our two guests, including Michael Shermer, who is the editor of Skeptic Magazine and the author of the forthcoming book, The Moral Arc. He's also a regular columnist for Scientific American, and Stephen Meyer, who is a good friend, I will acknowledge that, and is the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute and the author of the national bestseller, Darwin's Doubt, and before that, the indispensable book about intelligent design, Signature in the Cell. Let us go to your calls and to Jim in Columbus, Ohio. Jim, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Michael and Stephen.
Hi. Yeah, I am a high school science teacher on biology, among other subjects. And I think it's important that you realize that the books that you're quoting and that you rely much upon are, well, you're looking at them from the perspective of a non-scientist yourself.
Okay. You're talking to me.
To whom is he addressing that? Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And it's important to fully appreciate the wedge strategy of ID proponents. That wedge strategy is an important part of their motivation.
Okay, describe what you consider to be a wedge strategy.
You're not aware of the wedge strategy?
No, I want you to explain what you mean.
It's allowing an opening for the supernatural in the understanding of science.
Do you want to comment on that, Stephen Meyer?
I think that's directed to me. First of all, I am a scientist. I'm a trained geophysicist. And secondly, our proposal for public education is very simple. It has nothing to do with imposing Christianity or Judaism or any other religion on the unsuspecting science students of America. What we're trying to do is to open up the way in which science is taught so that it's not so dogmatic and that students can learn about the criticisms of the theory of evolution or criticisms of anthropogenic global warming or many other theories that are taught in a very dogmatic way. The books that I was citing and books and articles are peer-reviewed things in evolutionary literature where leading scientists are acknowledging that the mechanism, the chief mechanism of evolutionary change, natural selection and random mutation, does not have the creative power that has long been attributed to it and which is necessary for the theory really to be fully explanatory. Students hear nothing about this in their textbooks. It's not even mentioned, and yet leading evolutionary theorists are talking about it all the time. This is just a matter of simple scientific literacy, and what we're advocating is scientists are saying there are problems with Darwinian theory. Students should get to know about it. It's that simple. That's a matter of scientific literacy.
Michael Shermer?
Yeah, the caller's references to the arguments that Stephen just made. What's behind them is that there's no natural force that could create the kind of diversity and complexity of life on Earth. Therefore, there has to be at some point some kind of a creative supernatural force, whether you call it Yahweh or a deity of some sort or whatever it may be. Something has to reach into the universe and stir the particles in a way to create that kind of complexity. But the caller, as a science teacher's objection, is that how do you test a supernatural hypothesis? I mean, you can say, well, I don't mean supernatural, I mean a creative force. Yeah, but we already have a creative force called natural selection. No, I don't mean natural selection. I mean a different kind of creative force. If you push it hard enough, you're going to end up with a supernatural creative force, and that's what science teachers object to, because there's no way to test that.
One of the other questions that occurred to me, and in fact, let us go over to the global warming issue. Michael Shermer, do you think it's appropriate for children in school who are learning about climate change to hear from some of the climate skeptics?
Sure. In fact, we publish a booklet on how to debate a climate skeptic because we present their dozen best arguments that they have and then the dozen best arguments against those arguments by climate scientists. And you can use that as a teaching tool. It's just a little 25-page booklet.
Well, that was a shameless plug. 30 seconds, Stephen Meyer.
Well, again, Michael's organization's guilty of a lot of selective skepticism. You can tell by the very booklet that they've already made up their minds on the question of climate change, which is an incredibly complex issue. I was at a conference over this summer with Will Happer, one of the leading Princeton University professors in physics, who's also a profound skeptic of climate change. A lot of good reasons to be skeptical. We've had very little change in the last 17 years, though all the models predicted based on CO2 emissions that we would be experiencing a lot of warming. If the models don't retrodict well, why should we accept them as predictive?
We'll be right back. Four minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, and I've become interested particularly in eagle nests because not too far from my home, a pair of bald eagles are in the process of building a nest. And I didn't know this. I'm sure that our two guests both do, Michael Shermer and Stephen Meyer, both of whom are distinguished writers on science. And gentlemen, eagle nests are typically 2,000 to 3,000 pounds, and they are 8 to 12 feet in diameter, and they're extraordinarily elaborate. And these big birds, but they have small brains, build these nests over a period of months, sometimes 2 years, assembling them with amazing architecture. And again, you're talking about very, very elaborate nests. Michael Shermer, is it your best understanding that this kind of animal behavior would be something that has evolved? Because it hasn't developed. It's not sort of a cultural inheritance. The eagles weren't taught how to build the nest by a grandfather eagle. How does this come about?
Well, most nest building in birds is instinctive. It's genetic. It's passed down. The building process itself was evolved, but just current ones that are just born. They're born knowing how to do it. Now, there may be a critical period, a critical window in time when they have to be exposed to certain eagle cultural elements, so to speak, being born in a nest and exposed to it and that sort of thing. But most of it is laid down genetically, which gets back to that earlier question of why is there no cultural progress in other species besides humans? And it is curious, but it could be you need a combination of things, not only the capacity to learn and communicate what you've learned to the next generation, but also you need something like hands. Dolphins are never going to be able to build tools, and elephants likewise. The trunk is magnificent, but it doesn't have a opposable thumb and so on. Chimps would be the only one, and it could be their brains are just too small. They're just a quarter of the size of humans. You just may need to bolt on more neurons to be able to have that capacity to do that. So it is a curious problem in evolution and history, cultural history, as to why we're the only species that do that.
Stephen Meyer.
Well, that's a really great example of one of the really profound problems in evolutionary theory, because obviously the cognitive capacities of animals, whether they're fish or eagles or many, many examples of animals that are exercising instinct in a way that's profoundly informative and building complex things or negotiating or navigating complex pathways, is coming from some kind of pre-programming. It's not in the cognitive endowments of the animal itself. So where's that programming come from?
And that's I guess what I'm wondering about is, did Darwin believe that sort of the better nest builders among bald eagles had an evolutionary advantage?
Well, it's pretty hard to explain that series of incremental selectable advantages. Either you have a nest that works at that high altitude in the top of the tree or not. But the real problem is, where does the programming come from? Where does all that information come from? And that is the central issue in my book, Darwin's Doubt. It's the issue all throughout biological evolution. Because like our own computer systems, you can't build anything new without new code, without new information. And Michael said it's genetically endowed. Where does the genetic information come from? Mutation and selection is a really crummy explanation for the origin of new information, because mutations are essentially copying errors in pre-existing code. What we want is an explanation for the origin of new code.
Well, let's.
If I can ask Stephen, then where do you think nest building capacity comes from? Was it designed into the first cell? Do you think God or a creative force? There's a nest building creative force in the universe somewhere that comes down and tweaks the genome of eagles, or what?
I think the information you need for all complex features ultimately comes from design. So I'm a proponent of an intelligence being involved in the process of life's unfolding in the history of life on Earth.
But do you think there's a higher intelligence that creates nests for eagles?
No, I think there's a higher intelligence that generates the genetic code that makes it possible for eagles and other such animals to.
So it is genetic. You agree it's genetic?
I think it's partly genetic. It's also partly epigenetic, because genes only build proteins. They don't build.
We're in agreement on that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Eric in New York City. Eric, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Michael and Stephen.
Hi. I guess my question is actually similar to the one that Michael Shermer just asked Stephen Meyer, so it's going to sound pretty similar to that, but it's basically that, right, assuming that Stephen Meyer believes in God and that he believes in some kind of evolutionary process and that he doesn't think natural forces are sufficient to fully account for life as it stands now or for the evolutionary process, how does he think and what way is God involved in that process?
That's a great question. I understand the cognitive dissonance my position can sometimes induce for people, so it might be good to back up and just explain the basic idea of intelligent design. There's a positive reason to consider that an intelligent cause played the role in the history of life, and that is that we know of only one cause for the production of information, of digital code. And what we're finding inside living cells and what we find in the history of life is not only information, but periodic infusions of new lines of code, new information. The Cambrian explosion event that we were talking about at the beginning of the hour is one such event. So I think when you see these big infusions of information at episodes throughout the history of life, you're actually seeing evidence for the activity of a designing intelligence.
Michael Shermer?
Well, I guess, again, the question would be, when egg-laying birds came along, do you think the creative force or God or whatever then infused into the system, the DNA or whatever, the capacity to build nests?
Yeah, right. I don't see any problem with that, Michael. Is that scandalous? I get it from a materialistic point of view, but if you're willing to concede the possibility that an intelligence played a role, when you see events in the history of life where there are large discontinuous infusions of new amounts of information, that looks to me to be evidence of a designing intelligence playing a role. We know of no other cause for the origin of code than programmers.
And we have a designing intelligence here in the part of coming up to a break. We're joined by Michael Shermer. He is the author of the forthcoming book, The Moral Arc. We'll post information about that soon-to-be-released work, and we'll also be posting at our website information about Stephen Meyer and his best-selling book, Darwin's Doubt. We will be right back with more of your calls and conversation.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show.
55 minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show. It's such a pleasure talking to Michael Shermer and Stephen Meyer that you can kind of lose track of the time. We do have a few minutes more left with Michael Shermer, editor of Skeptic Magazine, and Stephen Meyer, who is the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. Let us go to Frank in Burlington, New Jersey. Frank, you're on the Medved Show with Stephen and Michael.
Hi, guys. This is really a great show. It's really interesting. We could all agree that, like, mutation, natural selection, they all affect change within a species, but they don't add any genetic information. What's the biological mechanism that allows for an increase in the genetic complexity in an organism?
Quick answer, Michael Shermer.
Well, symbiogenesis, Lynn Margulis's theory that early cells sort of combined DNA or genomes to make more complex genomes, which increases the information content. So that would explain the, you know, the earliest rise of complex life. The cells that, you and I are made of are called eukaryotic cells, and they have within them little organelles, which themselves, like mitochondria, were probably once simpler cells that got absorbed by more complex cells, and then they grew their genomes into more complexity, and that increases information.
Quick answer, Stephen Meyer.
Yeah, Michael's right. The endosymbiotic hypothesis involves absorption of pre-existing information. It's been one of the recurrent problems with all new theories of evolution is that they tend to have some advantages over neo-Darwinism, but they all presuppose but do not explain the origin of the new genes and proteins that are necessary to make new forms of life. I discuss five or six of these new theories in my new book, Darwin's Doubt, and it's an area of ongoing discussion, but it is the problem the caller highlights is a huge problem. Where does the new information, the new code come from? There isn't an accepted evolutionary answer for that.
Quick question, because we are so pressed for time, and a quick answer. Michael Shermer, your best guess as to the amount of environmental devastation through climate change in the next 50 years?
Okay, so I think climate change is real, primarily human-caused. I don't think that the potential for disaster is as much as some of the more alarmist folks say. I'm not terribly worried about it. I prefer technological solutions. Market technological solutions, I think, are there. People like Elon Musk and electric cars, things like that, I think, is the long-term future for solving the problem.
And your response, Stephen Meyer?
Yeah, I think all that new technology is really cool. I also, but I doubt the anthropogenic human, or the human-caused global warming thesis, and think that climate's incredibly complex, and we don't really know what's causing such very modest increases in temperature as we have seen so far. I don't think it's a big problem, and I don't think the problem, to the extent it exists at all, is likely to be mainly caused by humans.
Gentlemen, you are both not only fascinating minds, but wonderful writers. Michael Shermer's new book is called The Moral Arc. It will be out in January. Stephen Meyer's most recent book, just out in paperback, it's posted at our website, is called Darwin's Doubt. Both works very well worth reading for the edification and entertainment of this greatest nation on God's green earth.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.